Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
Folks, have a little listen to the man himself, Mr. Tommy Emmanuel, on guitar. He's a walking freak show, folks. Now you can see why he is most definitely one of my most favorite guests over the years. Not just because of his playing, though. It's because of his heart. I've not met probably a warmer person this... Well, maybe Kathy Lee Gifford might be as warm as this gentleman, Tommy Emmanuel. Good to have you, mate.
Hey, mate. How you doing?
My very, very good friend.
My very, very, very good friends in radio up there in Canada.
Oh, man. Well, I hope I've done my part to introduce the Canadian population to you.
You certainly have. I mean, the last... 5 years have been a beautiful growth for me in Canada. I haven't played over in Vancouver yet for quite a while, but things are going very well there in Toronto. And I went up to Ottawa last time.
Why?
It was very nice. I played in a huge church up there. And there was a very big crowd, and everything went well. So I like to get out in a boat, you know.
Oh, stop it. Out in a boat. Stop it. I remember first seeing you in a little place called The Basement in Sydney.
Uh-huh.
And then a little while later, I saw a gentleman named David Wilcox in The Basement in Sydney. And I tried to get David on the same show as you today, but David couldn't make it. So he's going to join us on January the 10th.
Oh, great.
And he said to say hello, apparently. He is a big fan of yours.
Oh, likewise.
Now, we're talking about not the Canadian rock and roll David Wilcox, although right. He's probably a really nice guy, too. We're talking about the singer-songwriter David Wilcox.
Yeah, yes, indeed. I know who you mean.
Yes. So he likes you. I just thought I'd share that.
Oh, thank you very much. How are you doing?
Let's talk about me.
Yeah, enough about me. What about you?
This is what Kathy Lee Gifford did to me, too, as well. I see, I tell you, the warm people actually care and ask these
kind
of things.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, last time I saw you was just when I was there last time. You remember you came to the, was it the first night or the second night?
I can't remember, but it was
anyway,
a big church.
Anyway, you were there with your bride, and you looked happy as a bird.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Chet Atkins, when was the last time you had a conversation with him? Because he's been gone for how long now?
He's been gone since June 30th, 2001.
Okay.
I was just putting one of my favorite photos of Chet. I was just cleaning some of my furniture here in my house, and I just put that photo out this morning. Funny, we should be talking about the good chief.
Mm.
The last time I saw Chet was 4 days before he passed. Mm. And he was in a wheelchair, and he was in the granny flat where I used to live at his house. He had a granny flat built on the side of the house, and it just looked like part of the house the way they did it, but it was completely self-contained, had its own bathroom and kitchen and lounge room and bedroom. And you know, I used to stay there when I'd come to Nashville, so him and I could, you know, work together and have fun together. And he told me one day, many years before he died, we were sitting in there having a cup of coffee one day, and he said, you know, I really built this for myself. He said, this is where I'm going to end up when I get old and sick, and I don't want to be a burden on Leona, so I'm going to come here, I'm going to live down here, and I'm going to have 24-hour care. And that's exactly what he did. The last time we were together was a beautiful day. I had flown in because his doctor had rang me and said, you should come now. And so I did. I jumped on a plane and flew from England. And I came in and we had a beautiful day together. I sang some songs with him. I played some songs, but he couldn't play at that time. He totally lost his motor skills. The only thing he could do was to put a spoon in his mouth. That's all he could do. And before I left, I got down on my knees in front of him in his wheelchair, and I held him. We held each other for a long time, and I told him how much I loved him and that I would always honor him, and I'd do my best to spread his joy around. And then I left, and I got back to my hotel. And the nurse rang me at my hotel and said, I just want you to know that when you left, Mr. Atkins cried, and he said, I'll never see him again. So that was the last was the last meeting. Although, I think he's visited me several times on stage.
I can imagine.
I sense him all the time.
Do you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Eric Clapton, what was your time with him? By the way, we're just doing a few casual yarns here, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, we are. Don't switch over. It gets better in a minute. Room service, send me up a room.
Oh, what is wrong with you? Seriously.
Everything, I guess. dear. Anyway, my time with Eric Clapton was lovely. It was in 1990, and he was on tour with his album, The Journeyman. And which has, by the way, the greatest version of Ray Charles's Hard Times I've ever heard. Arif Mardin did the arrangement and everything on that track. It's brilliant. But anyway, I did the tour. I was the opening act for Eric Clapton. And I was playing electric guitar and had my band and everything at that time. And so the very first show was in Adelaide in South Australia. And I got a standing ovation about four times during my set.
Wow.
And the local promoter was a bit worried and came up and chastised me and said, look, the opening act's not supposed to get a standing ovation. You're supposed to just play for 20 minutes and get the hell out of there, you know. And anyway, so people were going nuts and we were just smoking it, you know. And, yeah. And so Eric's guitar tech came up to me. Lee Dixon, his name is. He's still with Eric. Lee came up to me and said how much he loved what I did and everything, and he said, I'm going to get Eric to come and see you tomorrow, because Eric never turns up until like 2 minutes before he's due on stage, he'll just suddenly appear. And so the next night we were playing in the same place, and I came out to play, and I looked over the side of the stage, and there he was and smiling at me. So then I got invited back to his dressing room, and we kind of hung out a little bit. And he's a man of few words. He's a very quiet-spoken guy. And he'll tell you that he's a curmudgeon-y old sod, you know. He'll tell you that he's a cranky old guy. But he was nice to me, and his parting words to me were, you've been doing this a long time, you're doing well, keep at it, kind of thing. That's what he said to me.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, a good friend of yours has been in the news lately, something about copyright infringement happening. Are you not on the same label as Joe Satriani?
Oh, Joe.
Yeah.
I saw that. Joe is the one who's bringing the litigation, isn't he?
I think so. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
I hope he wins it.
I hope so, too. What's the name of the band that copied his stuff? Coldplay, yeah. Yeah, well, that's...
Coldplay.
Allegedly. Do we have to use that word? Allegedly. Although my son said he was listening to some station the other day, and they played it back-to-back and kind of over-mapped it, and it was just identical. It was just absolutely...
Really?
Yeah.
Ah.
So...
Well, you see, the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
Apparently.
Let me tell you something. This is not meant to be... Uh-oh. Putting anybody down, but
yes.
I just wanted to tell you that I have a very good friend who's a very good guitar player who lives in London, who is a good friend of Madonna's, And he would always get booked by Madonna to come and play at her parties, so he could play a bit, and then she would sing, and they would do all sorts of music. Well, at one of Madonna's parties, Gwyneth Paltrow and her husband, who's the lead singer of Coldplay,
right,
were there, and my friend who was playing there said, he said, they're having a good time, except for the guy. The guy from Coldplay, he said he sat at the bar and drank diet water all night.
Oh, man.
So we ended up calling him Diet Water Boy.
Of course
anyway,
you would.
There you go.
Now, listen, you've got story after story after story. I love listening to you. Some of the people that you've rubbed shoulders with, some of the people you've worked with. Of course, Joe Walsh as well is another name.
Yeah.
When was the last time you had done any work with him?
Well, the first time I met Joe was in Australia at a concert, and we were playing outdoors. It was a big event to bring the attention of the media to the plight of Bondi Beach and the fact that they were pouring sewage into the ocean and all that. So we put on this concert called Turn Back the Tide, and Joe came along with a band called the Party Boys, which was very aptly titled for Joe in those days. And I was a bit of a party boy myself back then.
Yes.
But anyway, I saw Joe, and he played great and sang great. And then the next time I saw him was when I was in L.A. making my album, The Journey. And Joe came in and played Slide on the opening track. He won't remember it, but then, of course, Joe goes to AA now, and he's in good shape. And
so has he cleaned up, has he?
Oh, he's doing great.
Oh,
yeah.
Good on him.
He even talks. He's written a song called One Day at a Time, and
wow,
it's brilliant, you know. And he's spreading the message about clean living and all that stuff. So
wow,
I'm really glad for him.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad for you too, mate. And of course, that's one of the reasons we've got you on the show today.
Because I'm a drug addict.
Well, pretty much, yeah. Pretty much. You had shared at the last concert that last year was a bit of a tough one for you, and you'd gone through some stuff.
Mm.
And I said to you backstage, I said, would you ever consider talking about that? How open do you feel you could be? And you said, I think I'd like to do that.
Yeah.
And that's why I've got you on today, because I know that you had a tough go with the coke and the booze.
Yeah. Well, I have a very addictive nature, as you can imagine. You know, I'm one of these people, unfortunately, when I do something, it's 120%. You know, when I play my guitar, I throw everything I can. I give it everything I got every time. If I take drugs, I do the same, you know, and it's unfortunate because, I haven't had that problem for years. When I was a young whippersnapper back in the early 80s, I moved to Sydney from the country, and I, started getting a lot of work and working in studios and being around people, and there was always drugs around. And, I wasn't into smoking drugs. I wasn't into go slow drugs. I was into go fast drugs. And so it didn't take me long to kind of start to have it on almost a daily basis. And then, of course, my first marriage went by the wayside because of that, and so I gave it away, and I got myself together, and that was great. But it's an ongoing, it's a daily battle, really it is, and it's something that never leaves you, I don't think. And the only way that you're going to get on top of it is to total abstinence, and beware of things that trigger you. There are so many triggers, like places you go, if you drink too much, all that kind of stuff. There's so many triggers.
So the drinking led to the coke?
Yes. I think it was a bit of both. But, I'm one of these people that I've been so busy and been so committed to what I'm doing that there are some times when it just seems like I have nothing for myself. I have nothing left to give. I'm empty, and I have to stop. And when I get like that, they're the times that are dangerous.
Tell me, I've never taken coke. What's it like?
Oh, it's you don't ever want to start, please.
Yeah, well, I wasn't trying to get like tips or anything from
No.
But
well, it's a high like you've never felt.
I mean, let's not kid ourselves. People love it for a particular reason. Why do you love it?
It's the most addictive drug that I can imagine, apart from, I think nicotine is probably the worst one for people to give up. But, it's such a powerful thing. And
Is it something that you would have to do really secretly and in private, or was it a party social thing that you would do?
Oh, no, it was very much private.
Right. And was it before a gig?
No, it was, sometimes, but it depends. I mean, I used to do a lot of studio dates. I'd work, from 8 in the morning till 8 in the evening. Then I'd go out and play 2 gigs, and by midnight I'm exhausted, so I got to have something to pick me up. You got to get up to get down,
Right.
So that's kind of what it was like. It was like it kept me going. It kept me pumped, and I could get out there and play, and on no sleep and no food and stuff like that.
But you'd have to be secret about doing it.
Well, as secret as you could be, I guess. I don't definitely condone it in any way, and I'm glad to be rid of it. My life is so much better without it. My playing is so much better. My brain is so much better,
Yeah. A little honesty, are you really glad to be rid of it?
Yes, I am.
And do you think you really are rid of it?
I hope so. I think having an addictive nature, and also addiction is a disease in itself,
mm-hmm.
that needs a daily, you need to be aware of that. And I remember when I went to rehab and they said, be careful of HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, or tired.
Yeah, those are your triggers. Those are the triggers.
They're the main triggers.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, last year I spent half the year being hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. So that was another reason why I kind of fell down last year. Just everything got too much for me. And
Do your kids know?
Yes, they do.
I
don't hide anything from my family.
I would think that would be, there would be a shame factor that comes with this, which keeps you under the control of the substance, because to come out from that shame, there's freedom, but the shame keeps putting you down.
Yes, exactly. You've got to deal with that. First thing you've got to do is find a way of forgiving yourself. That's the first thing.
Of forgiving yourself of what? Of taking the drugs?
For messing up.
Right.
For falling for it, or for not having the strength or the willpower to pull yourself out of it,
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that's one of the hardest hurdles to get over, is forgiving yourself, that you're only human and that you have weaknesses and you have to look at them and face them. you can get help from the right people and get yourselves the tools with which to turn the whole situation around. And that's what I did. And I found it through AA.
Hmm. Every time I'm near you, every time I watch you perform, and many people have said this, you exude a spiritual glow, and that just sounds so Oprah, and I apologize for that.
No, it doesn't sound Oprah at all. I'll be really honest and open my heart completely now and tell you that it amazes me what God does through me. A lot of times I don't even feel worthy. But I know that he's made me worthy. But most of the time I walk around saying, why me? What's going on?
Yeah.
And I've learned that all I have to do really to get focused on what I'm doing, God doesn't expect me to do anything but the best I can with what I've got. And pass on the love that I've received, pass it on. I just honestly try to do the best I can and be as open and as honest as I can with my audience at all times. And I think that makes you a channel somehow. It makes you a vessel.
Well, you know what I really want to know? I got to know this, man. Here you are with the broken marriage, the past drug alcohol issues, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden last year it comes up again, and yet you're a Jesus guy, man. And, you're desperately, and I would say you would look at your attempts to follow Christ as sometimes you wonder, what am I doing? And is this real? And what do I really believe? And all these challenges come into our heads. And here you are, Mr. Drug Addict, Mr. Cocaine Guy, Mr. Broken Marriage. And how can you be a Jesus guy? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what outsiders think. And that's what our own shame-based theology thinks as well.
Exactly. But you see, God loves me. He accepts me as I am. He doesn't say, I'll only love you if you're perfect in every way. Nobody's that way, you know. And you've got to take heart and believe that the Father is waiting to embrace you. He's loving all over you already, you know. And I believe that when Jesus told the parable of the prodigal son, that he was telling us what his Father's really like. That's what I believe. If you think about the story of the prodigal son, the boy goes away and he gets the money, he goes away, he wastes and squanders it all, and then he's stuck, and then he decides, all I can do is throw myself at my Father's mercy and tell him I messed up, and that's all, I'm just going to admit it, and blah, blah, blah. And when he comes back, his Father sees him from a long way away, and his heart leapt in his chest, and he ran outside, and he danced around him, and his son tried to tell him, I'm sorry, this is what I did, to make his speech. And the father didn't even want to hear it. He was calling for the cow to be killed so they can have a feast. And my son who was lost is now found. That, I believe, is what God is like.
But, Tommy, you relapsed in a huge way again from something you hoped was behind you forever. Mm-hmm. Was there not a time where you sort of said, oh, my goodness, how can I claim to be a Jesus guy and be doing the coke here? I got to really question what the heck is going on with me spiritually, and maybe I should just stiff arm this trying to be like Jesus stuff, and because obviously I suck at it.
I'm not trying to be like anybody. I'm just trying to do the best I can with what I've got. I don't proclaim to be anything but a guy who's doing the best he can with what he's got. Hmm. I'm not anything but whatever God made me, you know. I have weaknesses like everybody else. I also have strengths. One of the things that I believe I do is everything too much, you know. When I love somebody, I love them to death, you know.
Speaking of that, how's Lizzie?
She's gone too.
Oh, mate.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I brought that up.
Yeah, thanks.
Oh,
she left yesterday. She's gone back to Delaware.
Now, like left?
Left.
Yeah. Oh, yesterday.
Yesterday. Yep.
Okay, well, might be time to play a song.
No, well, the thing is, you know, about 2 months ago, I was in Moscow, and I'd already known that Liz wanted to break away, and she wanted to go, and she was going back to university, but basically she wants to try something else.
Hmm.
And I just couldn't accept the situation. That's one of my biggest issues, Drew, is acceptance. I'm lousy at it. And I went into this church to pray, and I walked around, and it was just so beautiful. Everybody was praying in their own way, in their own little corner kind of thing. And I suddenly became so overwhelmed. I just almost fell to the ground in tears. And I just sat there sobbing for a long time.
Mm.
And, you know, as clear as a bell, God spoke to me and said, why are you loving her so fiercely? Give her up. She's mine, not yours.
Mm.
That's what he said to me. And I almost felt like arguing with him.
Wow.
But, you know, that's true. I mean, I love Liz fiercely, but I have to let it go. And that's it. That's life, you know.
Yeah.
How we respond to these things is what makes us who we are.
I want to play one of your songs right now and give people a taste of who you are and what you do. This is a beautiful, beautiful number. Folks, have a little listen to this. We're going to put Tommy on hold. He and I are going to catch up a little bit, and then we'll come back after maybe a minute of this unbelievable song from Tommy Emmanuel. We'll be right back. Thank you. You're listening to one of my most favorite guests over the years, Mr. Tommy Emmanuel. He has performed alongside hundreds of other musical legends, including Chet Atkins, Eric Clapton, Sir George Martin, Joe Walsh, Hank Marvin. He's even recorded sessions with Tiny Tim and Stevie Wonder. In Australia, I mean, this man's music and life are absolutely legendary. He began playing guitar as a child prodigy at age 4, learning to play by ear without any formal instruction. But today, we're just catching up with my good mate. You know what? We haven't spent miles of time with each other, but I don't know why I like you so much, you big jerk.
Well, you know, mister.
I think it is. I think it's your vulnerability. I think it's your authenticity. That I really grab
it. You know what? If there's anything I know, that there's no such thing as love without vulnerability. Hmm. There's no such thing. You know, to love properly and to live properly, you've got to be vulnerable. There's no other way. That's what I think.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, can you share my favorite story, please, with our listeners?
Which one?
Well, there's many, but this one, it jumps into my mind every time I talk to you. It's about how you found out about what a bass instrument actually is.
Well, yeah, if you go back to the late 50s, early 60s, in music there was a lot of instrumental around at the time. There was the Ventures from America. There were the Shadows from England, and they were wonderful. And my brother and I used to listen to them all the time, and I worked out how to play the rhythm and the bass part at the same time, thinking that the rhythm guitar did that. And So
let me just clear that up for our listeners. In other words, he would play the rhythm on this guitar he was playing. He'd pull out the guitar, he'd play the rhythm for the song, but he'd also play the bass line as well at the same time he was playing the rhythm, which is odd.
Well, a lot of people
are doing it now, but
at the time we didn't know about the bass guitar. I thought it was the rhythm guy's job, you know, and I was trying to be a good, solid rhythm player for my brother, and so I found a way of getting that sound. And it wasn't until we were doing a show around Sydney somewhere, and we were on in the middle of it, and we did our set, and the crowd went mild. And then we're standing off at the side, and then this band comes on, and they're a typical kind of surfy instrumental band, you know, Fender Stratocaster, Fender Jaguar, and a Fender Precision Bass. And I'm looking at this thing, and I said, what's that guitar? It's only got 4 strings. And this guy looked down, and he said, that's the bass, of course. You know, and I said, what's the bass? You know, I didn't know what it was. And then they started to play, and I realized what he was doing. And it kind of dawned on me, actually doing 2 jobs here.
Yeah, I don't have to work as hard. What am I doing?
But, you know, I believe it was nature's way anyway, because when I heard Chet Atkins, I could kind of hear what he was doing. And most people were totally baffled by it and said, oh, it's got to be a recording trick. You can't do all that at once. And I said, yes, you can. Watch this. And I'd do it, you know, and people's eyes would bug out.
Yeah. What was the name of that group?
The Rocketeers.
The Rocketeers.
Yeah. How about that? we had the Emmanuel Quartet for a while, but we had to change the name because people thought we were a classical, you know, string quartet or something.
Yeah.
And then we became, when the Safaris had a hit with Wipeout, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you remember that?
Yeah.
And
that was a lovely,
am I the
that
oldest
was a,
person on the line?
No,
anyway.
That was a lovely rendition of it, too, I might add.
Thank you very much, yes. So we decided to call ourselves the Midget Safaris, because we were little. So that was my dad's bright idea.
Wow.
So then, and then we became the Trailblazers.
You've had quite a storied career. Can you remember one particular time that you were absolutely gobsmacked by who you just met?
Yes, I can.
Other than when you first came on my show.
Exactly. The 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, my brother and I played
yes.
to 2.75 billion people. And I spent most of the day talking with the golfer, Greg Norman, who's a real lovely guy. And we left together. Everybody had to leave in military precision because it was such a big undertaking, as you can imagine. And there was you know, bomb squads and people everywhere, lots of police everywhere because of threats and things. But anyway, they called our name, and Greg and I got in the elevator and went down to the bottom in the car park in the area that was all secure, and the doors opened, and who was standing there? Henry Kissinger.
No way.
Yeah. And I said, he was greeting people. And I said, Mr. Kissinger, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm a big fan of the Olympics. Can you believe that?
Wow.
It's unbelievable.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Henry Kissinger, probably one of the most dangerous minds in the world with with what he knows.
Exactly. Another time, I was sitting in a very posh restaurant in Los Angeles, in Rodeo Drive and Beverly Hills. What was it called?
McDonald's?
Mr. Chow's.
All right.
Something like that,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Anyway, I'm sitting there with Olivia Newton-John and Steve Kipner, who I'd just written the song with. And who should walk towards me going to the men's room but Roger Moore? And he looked magnificent. He had a tan, and he had the typical, you know, blue jacket and gray trousers and lovely tie and everything. And he just looked immaculate, you know, like James Bond. And I went, as he got closer to me, I went to speak, and nothing came out, you know. And I just sort of went, oh, like that. And as he walked by, he leant down, and he went, I know. It was beautiful.
That's funny. I still prefer Sean Connery. He's my favorite 007. Who's yours? It has to be Roger Moore now.
Roger Moore. I don't know. Hang on a second. Let me. Sean Connery's here. Just one second. My name is Bond, James Bond. I was born in Edinburgh in 1939. Let's have a bit of fun with Mr. Goldfinger. What about this? You don't expect me to talk, do you? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Wow. Folks, this is Radio Theater live from Toronto.
That's right.
Unbelievable. Well, listen,
we could go into John Wayne if you like. You got a streak of kindness a mile wide.
Stick with the music, buddy.
You're the longest-winded bastard I ever met.
Stick with the music. Stick with the guitar. Well, listen, let's let everybody know before we say goodbye to you about this double live DVD, instruction DVD. You got so much product out there. What's going on?
What's going on? Everything. I've got a new live album, which is a double album, and it's coupled with the high-definition live in concert DVD.
Wow.
And there's also a new instruction DVD, which I was watching last night, and I learned a lot from it.
Yes. Yes. But I get the impression you are actually able to break it down so the simple folks can get it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I shot the instruction DVD with four cameras, one of them that could move up and down and kind of side to side, and the other three are static. And there's a special feature on it where you can push on the special features, and it'll slow things down, way, way down, but the pitch will be the same.
Wow.
It's very, very clever. New technology.
Well done. Folks, the website is TommyEmmanuel.com. The double live CD, the instruction DVD, the concert, high def, and whatever else. All that stuff is all there to be gotten. They go right to the website and pick this stuff up. Is that correct?
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you for...
I want to thank you, brother.
No, I want to thank you.
All right. Okay, you thank me first.
Okay, I want to thank you for...
Thank you.
For what is wrong with you? I want to thank you for sharing your guts. I do. It's the vulnerability that you have exuded, at least with me, has been astounding and long-lasting. The impression that you've left upon me in the very short time we've known each other is scary, actually. And no, it is, because... I don't know. I don't know what it is about you. God has gifted you not only just musically, but that, like I said, this light that shines out of your face is just unbelievable. So thank you very, very much for being
thank
the kind
you.
Of guy you are, Tommy.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah. Appreciate okay, you want to thank me now?
Yeah. Well, I did. Thanks.
All right. Okay.
All right.
Thought we were going to go a little deeper there. That's okay.
That's deep enough.
All right, folks, the one and only Tommy Emmanuel, and God bless you, mate. I hope
that he
blesses you in such a way that he freaks you right out and that you realize how absolutely much he is in relentless pursuit of you.
Thank you.
Love you, man.
Love you, mate. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tommy Emmanuel playing in the background there. We're going to go out with some of his tunes. And when we come back, the Journey Catch-Ups. Well, that's hard to say. Journey Catch-Ups. We thought we'd connect with a few people... from this past year's journey segments that we've done here on the show. So we're going to catch up with Jim Leake, the morning man of Joy 1250 here. As you know, the big explosion we had here in Toronto is his brother that was killed, the firefighter, and this will be the first Christmas for Jim without his brother Bob. So I want to see how Jim's doing. And folks, you can pray for all of these guests that are going to be coming up. Christy Healy, of course, the widow of Juno Award winner Jeff Healy. It'll be her first Christmas without Jeff as well. Of course, he passed this year. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.